I'm sorry. Hey, Tom, look at that, will you?
Let's call to order the House Committee on Land Use for Thursday, March 26, 2009. Colleagues and members of the public, I'm going to exercise the chair's discretion to rearrange the agenda briefly by opening a public hearing first on House Bill 3226, and then we will move to House Bill 3043, and then we will move to 2227 if time permits and paperwork catches up to us. So with that, I'm going to open a public hearing on House Bill 3226. Ms. Ross, would you summarize this bill, please?
Madam Chair, members of the committee. This bill creates a special cause of action against vineyards that appear diseased or infested that go untreated, requires notice to the Director of Agriculture as a condition to proceed, and prohibits a claim if the Director of Agriculture is engaged in abatement, provides a prevailing claimant to recover attorney's fees, costs, and a lien for any abatement they performed. There is also a dash one amendment.
Thank you, Ms. Ross. Mr. Conkling. Okay, great. Would you like to come and talk to us about this bill?
Madam Chair, members of the committee, my name is Jesse Lyon. I'm the attorney for the Oregon Wine Growers Association.
Thank you.
And I'm here to speak to you today about House Bill 3226. What I'd like to do, if you would, I'll read a statement. We had hoped to have one of our growers here today who was particularly affected by a situation just like this bill is intended to address, but he is out on the road selling wine today. So if you would, I'd read his statement, then I can address a few things specifically about the bill.
I think that would be helpful. Thanks.
All right. This is a statement that's prepared by Earl Jones, who is the owner of Abasella Vineyard Winery, and I'll make a copy available to the clerk. Earl says, vineyards are expensive, long-lived agricultural enterprises that have the capacity to yield a high-value farm-gate crop. However, infections and pestilence can destroy a single year's crop, or worse yet, kill the plant and infect the soil, rendering a valuable vineyard site unfit for planting. Vineyard diseases typically spread from infected vineyards to clean vineyards through passage of plant material, shared equipment, or by airborne means. Wine grapes, the core of Oregon's wine industry, are very susceptible to airborne mold known as powdery mildew. Active preventative measures such as sprays must be employed starting in the spring of each year to prevent this condition from causing serious crop loss in the late summer or fall. Vineyards that continuously lie fallow are not treated with these sprays, setting the stage for proliferation and eventually airborne dissemination of deadly organisms. Abandoned or neglected vineyards in grape-growing regions, thought to be free of disease, have historically been the first sites found harboring other even more dangerous microbial pests, such as phylloxera and mealybugs. Vineyard ownership may pass to parties or be sold to persons with no interest in farming or spending any money on disease prevention. Grape growers become very concerned when a neighboring vineyard is abandoned next to or nearby their own vineyards. Cooperative neighbors can resolve such issues. But if the new landowner cannot afford or will not take any action, the active vineyard owner is at risk. If these infectious agents were large and visible, such as a deer or a bear, then the vineyard operator at risk could simply fence his vineyard to keep the pest out. But these agents are invisible and airborne. A fence won't help. The only solution is to destroy the substrate on which the organism grows. Spray killing an abandoned vineyard is not prohibitively expensive, does not cause a financial loss, and can be of value even to disinterested owners. House Bill 3226 creates a reasonable path to protect Oregon vineyards before damage occurs from abandoned or neglected vineyards. So that's the statement by Dr. Jones.
Okay.
We've brought forward and suggested the bill as necessary to protect vineyards and active vineyard managers from those situations where a vineyard is purely abandoned. Once a vineyard is abandoned for even a couple years, there's such there can be such drastic growth of new shoots and suckers and overgrown canopies that they just truly become a harboring place for lots of pests and threats to other sources. Again, our advice, and I represent our clients specifically in the wine industry, is always to work it out with the neighbor. But in some cases, a neighbor may have acquired the property on a speculative basis, looking for future development or whatnot. And if that doesn't happen, they typically have ignored the vineyard and let it continue to harbor pests. Current law allows for certain public nuisances and actions for public nuisances, but that's only once you've demonstrated there is a specific effect, and after then the damage has occurred and it's really too late. So we've proposed this bill in order to allow a vineyard owner who's unable to work it out and get the attention of their neighbors first to go to the Oregon Department of Agriculture, raise their issue, identify the problem, and then if necessary, obtain a court order that would allow them to mitigate the problem themselves. And this is really narrowly tailored, I think, to abandoned and neglected vineyards and no other circumstances.
I'd be happy
to answer any questions.
Mr. Conkling, did you want to add anything?
I've read that.
Okay. Questions for this panel? Anybody? Thank you. I have two other people signed up to testify on this bill. I will invite Draken.
R-A-B-K-I-N.
Drabkin. How do you do? And Dan Hilburn.
Hi.
Mr. Drabkin?
Yes, thank you. My name is Jules Drabkin. I live in Yamhill County. We have about 10 acres that we're putting into grapes. So you would think that I would normally be in favor of something like this, but I am not. I'm certainly not in favor of one neighbor polluting the other neighbor's land, but I don't think this bill, which I see as being vague, overly broad, encouraging litigation, encouraging the officious intermeddler to annoy his neighbor, as not being a solution to any problem. I certainly have no objection that the Department of Agriculture, with trained people, educated people, bringing nuisance legislation to stop serious problems. Listening to the letter of Mr. Jones, it's true that powdery mildew is a problem. It's a problem in every vineyard, as far as I know, in the United States. Every vineyard in Oregon is spraying there's some issues about 3, 4, or 5 times a year, but every vineyard is spraying for powdery mildew. Phylloxera is a problem. Every vineyard in Oregon that's being planted today is certainly planting on what are called phylloxera resistant rootstock. So while that may not control the problem, it certainly goes a long ways to keep the problem under control. I think this legislation is ill-advised. For one thing, it's confusing. It appears to create a separate cause or a private cause of action. And I think you, because of the sort of general principle of unintended results or unintended results from that aren't immediately apparent, you can begin to, at least as I see it, have problems that you can't even envision today. It's actually sort of weird the way this bill is written, and in terms of whether it creates a private cause of action. In the last paragraph 7, it tells you that the remedy described in the in this law does not authorize the enactment of or creation any private right of action. So it says in there it's not a private right of action. But it amends ORS 30.936. 3936 says that there should not be a cause of action, a private cause of action, for based on nuisance. But then it goes on to say that the exceptions are, and the exception is, abatement of the nuisance as set out in the bill. So you tell me whether this is creating a private cause of action or not. It seems to me that it is, but on the other hand, it says that it isn't. The definitions in this legislation or this proposed legislation are so broad and so vague that it doesn't take long to imagine someone objecting to the deer coming onto the property, the voles or the moles coming onto the property. That falls within the definition of a pest. So the legislation, and I'm not going to waste your time going through examples of all of the sections here that I think are so vague and so broad as to be almost unintelligible. Finally, the legislation creates this cause of action. Now, given that these definitions are broad, they're general, they're vague, those of you who are familiar with lawsuits or are familiar on how you try a lawsuit, that calls for litigation in which there's only one way to present your litigation, and that is under the very expensive methodology of calling experts. And I assure you, if you're not already convinced, that you can hire an expert to say almost anything, and if you're willing to pay him enough. And so someone that brings this private cause of action will really be called upon to hire an expert. Someone that's resisting the cause of action will also be required to hire an expert. In addition to that, you're required to, of course, have an attorney. Farmer Jones is not going to show up in his coveralls and litigate this this issue. He's going to have an attorney. His attorney is not going to be able to litigate this without without calling experts. I even think that this legislation probably is unconstitutional. It probably violates a person's right to be secure in their property, in their homes, and because it allows this neighbor that you've been fighting with. Maybe the neighbor wants to buy your property at a reduced price. It allows, ultimately, this neighbor to come onto your property and, in quotes, abate the nuisance. And I think that violates some of our rights under the Oregon and federal constitution. So I think this is, while I'm not opposed to legislation, although I think it already exists, necessary to abate a nuisance, this is not the right legislation, and this legislation is going to accomplish nothing that it's called upon to do. And I frankly don't think there is an existing problem in this area. Vineyard land has, at one time, you may recall, those of you who were alive at least in 1968, that vineyard land was selling at $100 an acre, $200 an acre. Now vineyard land is selling at $20,000, $30,000 an acre. Someone that owns something that has that value is not going to let their land fall into disrepair or disuse for very long. So I really think this is a terrible piece of legislation, and I don't think you should pass this on into law. Thank you.
Thank you for your testimony. Mr. Hilburn.
Chair, members of the committee, my name is Dan Hilburn. I'm administrator of the Plant Division for the Oregon Department of Agriculture. The Plant Division deals with plant quarantines and pest and disease issues. We didn't have any prior knowledge of this bill, and we're not familiar with the particular situation that is designed to address. But there are two other ways where similar issues have been addressed, and we do have existing statutes which allow people to solve similar problems to what has been described this afternoon. One of them is the Farm Mediation Program, and that is designed to keep farmers out of court but allow them to resolve disputes, farmer to farmer or neighbor to farmer. That's available through the Department of Agriculture, and on the testimony there, it's Oregon Administrative Rule 603, Section 75. That's the Farm Mediation Program. There's another one, set of laws that has to do with control areas. And control areas are used in various parts around the state where you have concentrations of growers growing similar crops. So, for instance, in Hood River, there's a control area for fruit. There's one for cherries in Hood River and in the Willamette Valley. There's a mint control area in Klamath Falls area. So in those areas, the growers get together, they decide on the cleanliness standards, and then they come to us and say, help us put these into regulations so that everybody has the same cleanliness standards and everybody then benefits from those standards. And we have many of those control areas in this state. They're self-policed, but they tend to work very well because the department doesn't impose the standards. The growers themselves come up with them. So here's an example where if you had abandoned vineyards and that was a problem, you could have that right in your control area. And at the bottom of my testimony, there's a little bit from the Hood River fruit control area where it talks about orchards on abandoned properties and whatnot and how they are dealt with in the Hood River fruit pest control area. So those are a couple of existing remedies for situations like I think this bill is designed to address.
Okay. Any questions? Representative Wingert.
The dam?
Yes.
How would the wine grape growers in an area go about getting a control area? What's the process? I mean, are they under the law able to do that now, petition the Department of Ag and create such a...
Madam Chair, Representative Wingard, yes, they are. What they would have to do is get together and come to us with ideas for doing that. And we don't do this for individuals. It has to be... There has to be a consensus of growers in an area that this is a good thing to do. But they would get together, they would decide what are the pests or diseases of concern and what everybody needs to do with those pests and diseases. And if there are abandoned orchards, how those would be dealt with. We would help them turn those into rules, and then they would be adopted as a control area.
Follow-up, Madam Chair?
A follow-up, Representative, yes.
So would they also decide the boundary line?
Yes. Madam Chair, Representative Wingert, yes.
Thank you.
Any other questions, Representative Hanna?
Thank you. Are you aware of cases where this applies currently? I mean, is there litigation pending on a untreated orchard?
Madam Chair, Representative Hanna, I am aware of cases in the past where there have been abandoned orchards that we have dealt with, and we have caused them to be cut down or bulldozed out, or depending on what kind of plant and whether it would sprout back, we have required that action to happen in control areas. Yes.
Follow up. Could you quantify? I mean, what percentage of orchards, or a number of orchards in however many years? I mean, give us so that if we know if this is less than 1% of all orchards or.
Madam Chair, Representative Hanna, it's a small number. I've been in the Plant Division Administrator for 14 years, and I can think of three cases.
Thank you.
Anyone else? Mr. Hilburn, I just want to make sure I understand the testimony. You're offering that there are some remedies already available.
Correct.
But those don't necessarily conflict with what this bill is attempting to do. Or did I not hear that right?
Madam Chair, I am saying that those other remedies are available now for situations which I believe this is trying to address. So if you were to adopt this, you would be creating a new process on top of what we already have.
Okay, so I'm still not understanding if there's a conflict here. There are any number of instances in statute and rule where we give property owners or business owners two ways of accomplishing an objective. Sometimes because one is quicker, one is cheaper, one is more readily suited to the particular configuration they are. So I'm trying to understand if there's a conflict here. I heard your point that you think there is already a mechanism, but I'd be more interested in knowing whether there's a conflict here.
If you were to do this, you would be adding another process, which wouldn't conflict with what already exists.
Okay. Representative Clem?
Thank you. In the existing process, is there any sort of appeal rights or something where if somebody, you know, through no fault of their own, had to abandon an orchard, that they would be able to make their case?
Madam Chair, Representative Clem, yes. The way it works is a problem is identified, and we go talk to them. We tell them what the rules are if they're not already aware of them, and give them a chance to take care of the problem. If they don't do that, then they fall into a civil penalty situation, and the first step of that is a written warning of intent to assess a civil penalty. And that they have a right to a hearing at that point. It can be either informal or formal. We have gone that far in one case, and after having that hearing, the person decided to do the right thing. If they still didn't do that, then we could assess a civil penalty.
Just follow up.
Representative Clem.
And there's some discretion to say you can't do the right thing because you're, for what, you know, you're unable to. You're no longer living in the property. You're somewhere else, and they have a valid reason. Could you excuse it, or how would that work?
Madam Chair, Representative Clem, there is discretion. The director has discretion to adjust the schedule and the timing of fines, but there's no provision for completely ignoring the rules. The rules are that if you abandon an orchard and that's part of the control area, you have to take it out.
Well, if I might follow up, this is a rather extreme example, but you know, my in-laws were incarcerated for being Japanese Americans, and their orchard was gone for 4 years. And so I'm wondering if somebody was incarcerated, somebody had a medical situation, would they have the option to at least appeal and say, you know, my government imprisoned me for my race. May I please not maintain my orchard for 4 years? I can't come to the court because I'm in a cattle car in Minidoka.
Madam Chair, we've never had a situation quite like that, but yes.
Thanks.
They have the ability to ask for a hearing.
Okay. Representative Greenlick?
Yes, I think I may. I'm not sure. I may need to have the first witness ask some questions, so. I want to ask some specific things about the deal.
Thank you. Mr. Lyons. See if Mr. Conkling is here, too. He's bouncing back and forth between hearings. Gotcha. Mr. Lyons, please. We have a few questions for you. Thanks,
Thank
Mr. Hilburn.
Mr. Lyons, can you help me understand what this bill actually does?
And we'll need your name again for the record.
Just Jesse Lyon again for the wine growers, Madam Chair.
There is in it something that says somebody can go to court. That's not new, right? Somebody could go to court. So the 4A says if a court finds in favor, it shall issue an order directing a person executing to abate the nuisance. Now, is B what's new? If that nuisance isn't promptly abated, then the court again may issue a writ of assistance? Is that new?
Representative Green, this is actually all a new procedure. I think the some of the mechanisms, whether it's within a control area or generally for the Department of Agriculture's administration against basically nuisances like this, part of what happens in practice is that the agency has only got so much time and so much enforcement ability to address situations like this in a timely manner. So in a significant way, what this is trying to do is enable a remedy. Again, this is almost entirely, we've observed in our industry, with absentee owners who have, they don't attend to mediation, they don't respond to the Department of Agriculture or their neighbors, and they purely are just, you know, kind of have not demonstrated any care for or regard for the industry in which they happen to have bought some acreage.
Madam Chair, can I try that question again?
Let's have a follow-up, yes.
Thank you. My question is, right now, an owner looks over at the field over here, and something bad's happening. Could that owner not currently go to court now to get something done about what's going on in the next? Is that new, being able to go to court for this?
Madam Chair, Representative Greenleck, today that owner would have to wait until there's a demonstrated harm to their vineyard, show damage.
Okay.
And then seek a monetary remedy. And frankly, those are much bigger and nastier fights.
I think that helps. Anybody else?
Thank you very much.
Okay. We have a fiscal statement here. The 3226. Why can't we move it? Because we don't have it with the dash one. Okay. Colleagues, Mr. Lyons, did you bring the, did your client bring the dash one?
Yes, we brought the.
Could you describe the dash one then, so that we can clearly understand that? Colleagues, we don't have a fiscal statement on the dash one amendment, although it is hard to imagine that it would change the fiscal statement. But Mr. Lyons, would you describe it?
Yes. The dash one amendments is designed actually to avoid the sort of battle of experts that prior testimony understandably raised some concern about, in particular by identifying that where there is vineyards over a year that have not been managed for any treatment, either by pruning or sprays or what have you, they may be found a nuisance that is a host of powdery mildew. So that's the clause B under the dash one amendment.
Thank you.
Sure.
Yes, Ms. Representative.
Do we have an amendment that fills in the blank on line 14?
That's a good question. Does the dash one amendment do that?
No.
No. The bill seems. The bill also has a non-trivial general fund impact statement, and although it did not come to us with a subsequent referral, I think this would have to be something that would need to be looked at in its current state by Ways and Means. Our options today, committee, are to accept the dash one amendment into the bill, which I think would be a fine thing for us to do. I think we would need to fill in the blank, and we would then need to decide whether this is a high enough priority from this committee to put it in the request list in Ways and Means. So I am not inclined today to move the bill, but I would entertain a motion to accept the dash one amendment.
Yes. Madam Chair, I move the dash one amendment into the bill.
Okay. Representative Garrett moves the dash one amendment into House Bill 3226. We can move it into the bill. We just can't move the bill out of committee without a fiscal statement. We can put it into the bill. Discussion on that? It's the definitions. Any opposition to moving that amendment into the bill? Seeing none. So ordered. We will need to figure out how to fill in the blank on the first page of the bill before we can move this. So let's work with the advocates for this bill and see about doing that at a different time. First, let's close the public hearing on that bill. Open the work session, and now, Representative Garrett, may I have that motion?
Madam Chair, I move the dash one amendments into House Bill 3226.
Okay, we are now in work session and can do this legally. Representative Garrett moves the dash one amendment into House Bill 3226. Any opposition? Seeing none, done. And now I'm going to close the work session, and we will have to see about rescheduling the bill for another time. Thank you. Let's move to open a public hearing on House Bill 3043. Ms. Ross?
Madam Chair and members of the committee, the bill extends Metropolitan Service District jurisdiction to urban growth boundary upon passage and automatically thereafter upon expansion of the urban growth boundary. There is a dash one amendment.
Okay. Okay. Public hearing. I have two people signed up to testify. I'd like to call Richard Benner and Randy Tucker. Representative Greenlick is the sponsor of this bill, so if you would like to weigh in, let me know.
Thank you, Madam Chair, members of the committee. My name is Randy Tucker. I am the Legislative Affairs Manager for Metro, and there hasn't been a session in 10 years that I haven't testified before Land Use Committee well before the end of March, so it's been leisurely for me. Not for you, I understand. I am sending around a piece of an email that I received this morning or last night. I'd just like to... I'm going to mainly introduce Dick Benner, who is going to walk you through this bill and explain what it does and doesn't do. And then I would like to just tell you who we've talked to about this, if you're interested. And so far, I have not heard any opposition to the bill. So I just want to let you know that.
Mr. Benner?
Dick Benner. I work at Metro in the Office of the Attorney. This bill... does two things. It addresses two sets of problems that we experience with boundaries. And let me explain a little bit about Metro boundaries. As you all know, Metro has an urban growth boundary, and statute gives Metro the responsibility for establishing it and for changing it over time. We've done it many times since it was established in 1979. And the second problem has to do with changes to other boundaries, such as the boundaries of special districts, cities, formations of those things in the region. Let me talk first about our own boundary and that set of problems. I mentioned that we have an urban growth boundary. We are a special district, so we also have a district boundary. Those two boundaries are separate and distinct. Sometimes they're close to one another, sometimes they're not. They are changed and were established by separate processes. And consequently, they're in different places. And that's really the source of the two problems that I describe there under Roman numeral one in my testimony. The situation we have today and will remain a problem prospectively unless we take some action, is that we have approximately 4,800 acres that are inside our urban growth boundary, but not inside our jurisdictional boundary. The two problems I highlight here are the two principal ones we're concerned about. The first one is that if you live on that property, you are inside the urban growth boundary, but you don't have an opportunity to vote for the Metro Council president. You don't get to vote in your district for a particular Metro councilor. You don't get to vote on ballot measures that are occasionally in front of voters in the district. So you're affected by a lot of things that Metro does, but you don't get to vote for a councilor. That's from the landowner's point of view or the resident's point of view. From Metro's point of view, it's a different problem, and that is there is land inside our urban growth boundary, but because it's outside of our jurisdictional boundary, we don't have authority over it. So the things that we have in our Metro Code and other places that try to help urbanize those lands when they come into the urban growth boundary don't apply to those 4,800 acres. Those are the two situations that the first part of this bill addresses. And here's what the bill says. It says when Metro expands its urban growth boundary, and this is prospective only, let me say, until we get to Section 4, which I'll explain, prospectively only, when Metro expands its urban growth boundary, that land automatically comes into its jurisdictional boundary. So the effect of that is that when we take land into the urban growth boundary, the people who reside there, sometimes the owners, sometimes not, they are immediately represented. They have an opportunity to vote for all Metro elections, councillors, ballot measures, whatever the case may be. Second thing it means is that when it comes into the UGB, the urban growth boundary, and comes into the jurisdictional boundary, Metro then has jurisdiction over it. And the various code provisions that we have that we use to urbanize that land over time would apply. That's problem number one. Problem number two has to do with the other kinds of boundary changes in the region. Some of you may remember when we used to have local government boundary commissions. There were three at one time, one in the Portland metro area, one in Eugene, one in Salem. And they were regional bodies, and they regulated and okayed incorporations, annexations to cities, formations of districts, changes of boundaries of districts in a 1 to 3 county area. In the metro area, it was a 3 county area. Once Metro was established, questions arose about why we would have a boundary commission and a regional government. Ultimately, in the 90s...
Mr. Benner, I'm sorry to interrupt, but I think it might make more sense for us to let committee members focus on issues if they want the detail, out of respect for your time and the other people who are waiting for the next bill.
Okay.
So that... Okay. But finish your summary. And then if we want to drill down into the details, we'll do that with questions.
So the second problem is it's actually a correction. When the Boundary Commission disappeared, Metro took over the regulation of incorporations and districts and whatnot, changes of boundaries. That statute said the authority extends to lands designated urban reserves. Those urban reserves have gone away. They're invalid. We're in a process of designating new urban reserves. So what this bill would do is to say that forget about the old urban reserves. Your jurisdiction over these kinds of boundary changes would apply to any new urban reserves. We haven't designated any, but we're in the midst of a process to do so. So those are the two elements of the bill. Last thing I should say, Section 4 of the bill. Section 4 is not something that we wrote into the bill that we submitted to Legislative Council. It addresses something we did not ask for. What it does is it says those 47 to 4,800 acres already inside our urban growth boundary, which are outside our jurisdictional boundary, upon passage of this bill, are added to our jurisdictional boundary. That's different from what we were after. A good idea, maybe, but that's not what we asked for.
Thank you for the summary. Any questions for either of these two panelists, Representative Clem and then Representative Garrett?
I think, so separate from Section 4, for prospective annexations to the territory, do you use methodologies such as, you know, if you create island, I mean, just use the normal annexation statutes? If do you have annexation plan method? Do you have island annexation? Just all the same authorities that cities have currently and all the same sort of protocols around it?
No, Representative Clem, they're different. There are separate statutes that apply to formations and changes in boundaries of special districts that are distinct from the same for cities. Two different chapters, two different procedures. Some of them look alike. Special districts, unlike cities, for example, can have independent and separate annexations that are not contiguous.
Mm-hmm.
Cities can't do that, as you know. Cities have more methods than special districts do. Ours, in Chapter 198, talk about by petition. If you have the consent of all the owners, you don't need an election. double majority. If you have the consent of the owners of most of the property and a majority of the of owners, then you don't have an election. You can have an election. So that's the way you can do it.
Representative Garrett.
Madam Chair, I think just a historical question. Is it just happenstance the district, the UGB, and the jurisdictional boundaries have been distinct? Or was there a policy reason why they were distinct? And should we be aware of that in basically obliterating that distinction?
I think, Representative Garrett, it will take a long time before the distinction is obliterated because of the 4,800 acres
going
already
forward,
in.
Going forward, though, it's obliterated.
You know, in the history of Metro, there was before there was a Metro, there was work on an urban growth boundary, but it wasn't adopted.
Good.
Metro was established when it was established by a charter. With a charter, it was given a district boundary. And it was before there was an urban growth boundary. So whoever was drawing the district boundary was anticipating, let's put it where we think the UGB might go, but as time passes, we know that UGB is going to expand, so let's make it a little bit bigger than we think that first UGB will be, but it was a guess. And over time, it's proved to be right sometimes and wrong sometimes.
Okay, that's helpful. Thank you.
Did you have a question? Anybody else? Questions?
Question.
Oh, Representative Cowan.
Thank you, Madam Chair. Because I'm not terribly familiar with Metro, I'm not sure that I fully understand this question, but I think from what you have described, if you go ahead with the amendments that take out Section 4, then you're just talking about prospectively lands that are added. So just so that I understand correctly, if you look at the summary statement that we currently have for the existing bill without the amendment, the description of extending the boundary to the urban growth boundary upon passage would be incorrect without Section 4.
Correct.
It will have to be kind of restructured so that it says it more clearly. Is that correct?
We probably want to adjust.
Okay.
We can
work on that, and the only reason I asked it that way is because I was trying to get to sort of a one sentence of what it would do without Section 4. And I'm not sure I've heard that yet.
Let me try.
Okay.
When Metro expands its urban growth boundary, any territory added to the urban growth boundary that isn't already within the Metro jurisdictional boundary would at the same time become part of the jurisdictional boundary.
Okay. Thank you.
Any other questions for the panel? Is there anyone else who has come in who would like to testify on House Bill 3043? Okay, we're going to close the hearing on that. You ready to go? And I'm going to open a work session on House Bill 3043.
Madam Chair, I move the Dash 1 amendments be incorporated in House Bill 3043.
Okay. Representative Greenlick moves the Dash 1 amendment to House Bill 3043. Discussion on the motion. Representative.
I'd just like to make a comment, Madam Chair. The bill, as we wrote it, did not include this. It came in accidentally, and consequently, I really haven't had a chance to check in. There are some significant areas in my district, and I can't figure out exactly where there are that would be brought in. I feel very comfortable with the idea of moving forward that this annexation take place, and since there wasn't necessarily a very strong preference, although I'm sure Metro would rather have it, I feel more comfortable with the bill this way. If they move over to the Senate and can convince the senators to accept this, I would, now that we've all had a chance to think about it, I'd be very happy to testify at that point when we're thinking of doing it. But I think right now, I very strongly favor the bill moving forward, and I think it moves easier without the Dash 1s.
Okay, thank you.
I mean, with the Dash 1s.
With the Dash 1. Any further discussion on the motion? The motion is to adopt the Dash 1. Seeing no further discussion, are there objections to the motion to amend? Seeing none, we'll accept the dash one amendment.
Madam Chair, I would be happy to move that we, let's see if I can get the script right.
We've got one for you.
Thank you very much. Madam Chair, I move, let's see, we're past the dash ones. Madam Chair, I move House Bill 3043 is amended to the floor with a due pass recommendation.
Representative Greenlick moves House Bill 3043 as amended to the floor with a due pass recommendation. I will note for the record that we have received the necessary fiscal and revenue statements, and they are nil.
That's correct, Madam Chair, on the original bill and the amendment.
And on the bill as amended. So is there discussion on the motion to move the bill to the floor? Representative Clem.
I know we're in now the motion, but may I ask a question of only committee members or of our friends here at the dais or at the whatever that is?
We'll allow a little leeway, Representative.
Okay. So just one question. So going forward, if areas, UGB moves and areas are brought in and then they are annexed not to the cities or anything but to your jurisdiction, and then it creates islands of these acres that are really under discussion in Section 4, is there an island methodology within your statutes that then allows for immediate annexation?
No.
Yep. Okay, motion to move the bill to the floor. Any objections? Representative Wingert, we're on House Bill 3043. We have moved the dash one amendment into the bill, and now the motion before us is to move the bill as amended to the floor with a due pass recommendation. Any objections? Representative Wingert?
Yeah, Madam Chair, I'm not comfortable with the bill yet. I was hoping to have some time. I became aware of it yesterday for me to understand, because I've seen the map, and there are a number of locations within my district, and I just want to have a better understanding of who those folks are and how they feel about it.
Representative Wingert, the dash one amendments takes out the immediate annexation of any territory outside the jurisdiction, but within the urban growth boundary. But I understand if you're interested in reviewing the bill, that's certainly understandable. So are there objections to moving the bill to the floor? Would you like to be listed as an objection?
Yes.
That's fine. Representative Wingert objects. Motion carries. Representative, would you like to carry the bill? Representative Greenlick will carry the bill. Close the work session on House Bill 3043. Okay. Open a work session on House Bill 2227. We just posted the work session.
That's right.
Okay. House Bill 2227. We have spent a fair amount of time on this bill, colleagues, and we have several amendments before us, including one that is not quite hot off the press but has just recently arrived. And I wouldn't normally do this, but there was a clarification, a kind of a Scribner's error, and we're correcting that with this amendment. I'm going to make copies available to the audience as well. Mr. Hoyt, can you pass those out to them? You've got this, or do you?
Thank you.
Thanks. Thank you. Colleagues, you have had the dash 5 amendment. The dash 7 amendment, which we are passing out, makes one change only. It is essentially the dash 5 amendment, with the exception on... let's see if I can find it now. That's not it. Page 4, line 1. The intent all along was for the limitation to be applied only to irrigation districts, but in defining that in the Dash 5 amendment, we included all districts, and so we've added the word irrigation district and corrected the ORS citation. That's the only change from the Dash 5 amendment. So, since we're in work session,
Madam Chair?
Discussion, yes.
There was a letter that went around by email today from a law firm that had Schwabe, is that right?
Mr. Livingston, who testified for us.
So you're planning to bring him up to?
I was planning to.
What, did you want to bring him up? I'd actually like to, I'd like to review what we have here. And answer some of the questions you specifically had asked earlier, Representative Wingert, and then if the committee, if in the context of any motion for an amendment it makes sense to bring experts up, we'll do that. But there was outstanding questions that were raised at our Tuesday hearing, and I'd like to bring either Mr. Morrissey or Mr. Whitman forward. Or both. We get both of them. This is as to the territory that would be affected by different sections of the amendment. Gentlemen, welcome.
Good afternoon, Madam Chair, members of the committee. For the record, Richard Whitman, Director of the Department of Land Conservation and Development. I have with me today Michael Morrissey, Policy Analyst in our office. We're here at your request to explain two of the provisions that there were questions about in the public hearing previously on Tuesday. Those sections are, and I have to apologize, I'm working off the Dash 5s, but I believe we're on the same page. Literally. Page 4 of the Dash 7 amendments, subsection 2, C and D, C dealing with irrigation districts, as you just discussed. We have two pieces of information regarding irrigation districts to help you get a sense of the extent of that. Representative Wingert raised that issue in the public hearing. One is a map, and actually on this one, Madam Chair, I'm going to let Mr. Morrissey explain the two pieces of paper that we're handing out to you.
Mr. Morrissey.
So here's what we have, Madam Chair and committee members. The map was produced by the Oregon Department of Agriculture.
We know who you are, Mr. Morrissey, but our equipment doesn't.
That's right. Michael Morrissey. I'm a policy analyst for the Department of Land Conservation and Development. We have two items that are portraying irrigation districts. The map was produced by the Department of Agriculture. It is not an exhaustive map of irrigation districts, but it does show some of the larger irrigation districts. The key shows you the names, and you can code those up with the location on the map. The printed list is a compilation that was put together by our department to satisfy the requirements of Measure 49, where Measure 49 includes, in its definition of high-value farmland, irrigation districts. So we have listed the irrigation districts. I wrote in, hand-wrote in, I'm sorry, I couldn't make it neater, but I hand-wrote in where I knew the acreage of those irrigation districts to help you get some sense of how large some of these districts are. These are districts that are organized under Chapter 545, and they're cited in our amendment, which actually refers to a definition, ORS 54505. And then under that, there is irrigation districts organized under Chapter 545. The one that I did leave off size-wise, if you just want to make a note, in the Central Oregon Irrigation District in Deschutes County, that's 44,000 acres. So there, I'm not aware of any better place to get an exhaustive list of irrigation districts than the one that we've compiled. We made quite an effort to mail out to each irrigation district that we were aware of, and I believe this comes very close to being an exhaustive list of irrigation districts.
Thank you. Mr. Whitman?
Madam Chair, I'm going to talk about the next paragraph, which is paragraph D, which refers to sites in which lands are predominantly classified as being in fire regime condition class 3. So the mapping that we have handed out to members of the committee is mapping from the U.S. Geological Service of fire condition classes in Oregon. It's the areas of Oregon where we have the majority of our destination resorts sited. So the first map that you have is Central Oregon, and the areas that are shown in red are condition class 3. The second map that you have is Northern Klamath County, and again, the areas in condition class 3 are shown in red. And then the last map is Jackson and Josephine County, and the same color coding. Areas that are shown in yellow are condition class 2. The areas in green are condition class 1. And the areas that show up in purple are irrigated agricultural lands. So the point of this mapping in the exercise that we went through in working on this particular provision was to try to get to, again, the highest risk lands in terms of risk of wildland fire. I'll remind you that we also put a provision in that allows resorts to be sited even in these areas that are shown in the highest fire class if a county goes through the planning process to reduce the fire risk in that area, either by treating fuels in and around the area where the resort is proposed to be sited, or by providing additional firefighting facilities, or both. So, Madam Chair, we'd be happy to answer any questions you might have on these provisions.
Any questions on the information that Mr. Morrissey and Mr. Whitman have provided?
Yes, Madam Chair.
Representative Winger.
Mr. Whitman, have you seen the letter from Peter Livingston?
Madam Chair, Representative Wingard, I've seen it very briefly. I have not had a chance to review it in detail, but I've seen it briefly, yes.
Well, what, his first objection.
Follow-up, Representative?
Yes. Follow-up, Madam Chair. I have a series of questions, if you permit. I'm just trying to figure out if you feel that the concerns that have been expressed have been either addressed or you have a counter-argument to, A, the first concern about destination resorts being within districts, irrigation districts or water districts, and it sounds to me like we might have addressed that with the change in the amendments. And then his second one was an issue about whether or not Class 3 as just a blanket prohibition is warranted, or whether or not somebody could do something in the course of the development that would bring the classification of that area down. And I realize you just made a reference to that in subsection D here. So I'm wondering if you feel like his concerns have been addressed in the amendments.
Madam Chair, Representative Wingard, let me speak to the fire issue first. I believe they have been. As I said in my testimony, this is not an attempt to put out some sort of blanket prohibition on large areas of Oregon for siting of resorts. So we've chosen the rating and the mapping of areas at high risk of fire that is really it's the smallest area, frankly, that we could find that somebody had mapped for high risk of fire. There are several classification systems. And then we put that clause in allowing resorts to be sited even in those high risk areas if the property owner and the county go through an exercise either to plan fuel reduction or to provide additional firefighting services within that area. And I think that's what Mr. Livingston was referring to in his letter. So if you really want to hear, you probably should ask him, but I think from my perspective, I think on the fire question, we've addressed that concern.
Okay.
On water and irrigation districts, again, and I want to take responsibility for the glitch in the language there. The intent, as your chair has said, was to restrict the limitation only to large irrigation districts. And the wording that we had in there, it was a long list of districts. So when we realized that, we immediately worked on changing the language so that it is only irrigation districts organized under Chapter 545, which by and large is the large irrigation districts in the state. As I understand the policy reason for having that be a screen for the siting of destination resorts, it comes out of the experience working with a number of districts on resort issues that they, not necessarily all of them, but a number of them have expressed concern about having resorts sited within the districts because it removes those lands from potentially being irrigated farmland within the district that contribute to the agricultural infrastructure of the district. That's the concern. There may be some districts who would love to have a resort within their boundaries and provide them with water, so there may be some varying viewpoints among districts on that issue. This does not preclude a property owner and a district, if they want the resort to go forward, from amending the district boundaries and taking that land out of the district and allowing the resort to be sited.
Follow-up, Madam Chair?
Yes, Representative, one follow-up, and then we've got other folks.
Mr. Whitman, if the concern is that some irrigation districts wouldn't want it, why wouldn't we word this to say that it's prohibited unless an irrigation district approves it? So that those irrigation districts who do find a reason, of whatever value they place on it, whatever their reasoning is for doing it, they are at least permitted, it's permissible, rather than the blanket prohibition here, which you say might conflict with what some irrigation districts desire.
Madam Chair, Representative Wingert, I think that's a policy issue about whether the state as a whole wants to essentially have land within irrigation districts be for irrigated agriculture as opposed to destination resort development. Mm-hmm. And that's an issue for you folks to decide.
Okay. Representative Hanna, you had a question?
Thank you, Madam Chair. And I'm sorry, I was upstairs testifying, so I got here a little late, and if I repeat a question, forgive me. Mr. Whitman, the inclusion of the irrigation district piece eliminates how much pre-mapped property from development, acreage that's already been designated as destination resort.
Madam Chair, Representative Hanna, I don't have an exact figure for you. I believe there probably are some lands in Deschutes County and Crook County that are currently mapped, although with Crook County they've withdrawn their map of destination resorts that were previously mapped, that are within irrigation districts. Those are probably the main area. That's probably the main area of the state where this is potentially an issue. I do not believe it's a significant issue in Klamath County or in Jackson or Josephine County or any other part of the state.
Yes, a follow-up, but I want to be clear that the bill is this bill is prospective. So any existing maps are not affected by this bill.
That's not right.
This bill is only prospective. So if you have an am I correct in that understanding? So if you have an existing map that happens to be within an irrigation district, this bill does not invalidate that map.
That's correct, Madam
if
Chair.
This bill with that amendment, with the Dash 7 amendment, wouldn't invalidate an existing map. Follow-up, Representative.
Thank you, Madam Chair. This is on that topic. I'd like to have legislative counsel explain that because, as I understand that, unless you had applied for that destination resort, this bill would impact those lands mapped. And I'm open to having that discussion, but I believe that, I mean, that's my understanding.
Yes, please.
Clarify
Madam
that,
Chair,
and you can correct me if I got
Hanna.
It wrong.
So the answer that I just gave to Chair Nolan is correct, but I think what you are really asking is the provisions here, the screens here apply both to mapping, and as your chair has just said, this bill is prospective, so it would not affect the mapping. But these criteria are also criteria for the siting of a destination resort. So if there's a new application that is filed after the effective date of this bill, again, it is prospective, then these criteria would apply to that new application. So I think that's the clarification that you're referring to.
All right.
Okay.
Chair?
Yes, Representative.
Whether or not that property exists on the map today or not.
Madam Chair, that's correct.
Okay.
Thank you.
Another follow-up?
Yes, please.
Okay.
Thank you. I asked on Tuesday, I think, about this question of knowing how many acres it would remove from the probability. I'd still really like to understand that question, and so I'm open to you replying to that back to the committee. It doesn't have to be today, but I think it's important for all of us to understand that before we proceed. My next question relates to, do water districts currently sell water to destination resorts?
Madam Chair, Representative Hanna, I suspect that they do, but do not know for a fact that they do.
Madam Chair, I'd like to request that we follow up on that, because it's my understanding that not only do water districts sell water to destination resorts, that if those districts were asked, and I don't believe they were on this issue, they would come in and say, not only do the resorts benefit, but so does the water district by maintaining use of its available water. I mean, in other words, they have so many acre feet of water and they have a customer to purchase that water. So precluding them from doing so would actually be a loss of a major customer in some cases for water districts. So I think, again, it's quite important that we understand how many acre feet, or however you would like to measure the water purchased by those resorts, would become important.
And Representative, we can request that information, but again, since it's prospective, they would be losing a prospective customer, not an existing customer. So anyone who's currently got a customer wouldn't be losing that customer. They would have to adjust their future planning for their customer base and for their business management, but there isn't an elimination of an existing customer.
Thank you for that clarification, and I believe you're correct on that, but I do believe it provides the perspective to this committee for the type and size of customer that water districts supply water to. It also encourages water districts who have large destination resorts as customers to come in and tell us what they think about selling their water to those folks as customers.
Representative Hanna, what I said was we'd ask for the information about whether that's happening. If the bill moves out of this committee today, we'll have to find another time to testify.
Thank you, Madam Chair. I understand that, but that'd be a shame.
Any other questions for either of these gentlemen?
Madam Chair, I have questions. I'm not sure if they're for Representative Whitman or Mr. Whitman.
Okay. What kind of questions?
Well, for instance, we have dash sixes in front of us. I was hoping at some point somebody would explain to me what they do. I'm not familiar with them at all.
I'm not very familiar with them either.
Okay. And I know that there are some folks in the audience who have had some ongoing discussions with LCDC about some concerns that may, with a little bit of a delay and some language adjustment, actually improve the dash now sevens. When I had the conversation earlier today, we were talking about the dash fives. So I'm hoping that we're going to hear from those folks today.
I'm a little confused here, Representative, because I have extended an invitation on at least three occasions for people who have those ideas to come to me or the other people on the committee working on this bill. So I'm at a loss for how someone would come to a work session without having, I mean, I didn't know about anybody else who wanted to testify about this. Having had several public hearings on this bill and extended an invitation several times, I'm not sure I
follow. This committee member only saw the dash fives on Tuesday, so I've had 2 days to have some conversations about some of the issues that were brought up on in Tuesday's meeting, some concerns about language on the impact on roads and highways. And I think there are a couple of other concerns that have been expressed at different sections of this. I think the folks that I'm thinking of have some suggestions that I think are some what I would consider to be helpful amendments that would, I think, go a long way to improving the dash sevens now as they currently exist and to provide some comfort to the different stakeholders in this process.
Madam Chair.
Okay, thanks. Representative Clem.
Just to add into the equation, because I know we have two people at the dais. I had a visit maybe an hour ago while I was walking, maybe a couple hours ago, I was walking to my office from one of the parties, I think, at question, and I think maybe there are conversations with the agency. I don't know if these do, but someone at the agency, and it's possible you could get a little update, not to put you on the spot, but if there are, you get an update from the people already sitting there to see if, they're getting very far, but I heard about them about 2 hours ago, some conversations.
If there is an adjustment within the framework of the dash five or dash seven that would be relevant, that would be useful for the committee. But if we're going back and starting over, I'm not sure that that's a useful use of our time. Is there something that... Okay.
So, Madam Chair, will you allow me to call someone up who I think can articulate this a little better than
Representative, I'd like the courtesy of hearing about that ahead of the work session.
Well, I didn't
know. So if you'd
know.
Like to take a recess, why don't we take a 5-minute recess and let's figure out what's going on here.
I just made the assumption she was going to get it by that. I didn't realize that we were moving like
the work session.
That's all right. I didn't see it. Yeah, okay.
Bring up LCDs. Did
you just show the national
She told me she was talking to the agency.
Just be careful with that spelling. You're going to have fingerprints on
it.
When my murder is investigated, they'll know who is the responsible.
Whose is this?
I believe it's Representative Esquivel.
Esquivel?
Okay. I think so.
Hello, young man. How are you doing? My bill to abolish the counties, I haven't gotten any comment on it yet. It's not a problem. It's true. It's not a priority for me either.
So what other changes do you think
almost Friday.
Let's reconvene the work session on House Bill 2227. I've had lots of good ideas in the recess we took. What I intend to do is carry over this work session until our next meeting, next Tuesday. That would be March 31st. I would like to invite anyone who... It's the chair's intent to move this bill next Tuesday with the Dash 7 amendment, although I would also invite suggestions on how the Dash 7 amendment and the underlying bill with that amendment might be improved. But I just would like to make clear that the conversation should be within the context of the Dash 7 amendment. I would also like to be very clear that I would expect any suggestions to be in my office by 5 o'clock tomorrow evening. The clearer the written suggestion is, the more likely it will be something that we can incorporate or at least consider incorporating. A conceptual idea is not as helpful as a specific suggestion, which is not to suggest that any specific suggestions automatically get incorporated. I hope people understand that. And we will reconvene in work session on this bill next Tuesday. Representative Esquivel has volunteered to help us with that effort, and I appreciate his volunteering to do that. And once again, extend the invitation certainly to any members of the committee who have particular concerns or issues or who would like to spend some time with us on this bill. So let me know that, because I certainly welcome the input from other members of the committee. Any further comments that need to be on? Thank you all for your interest. Thank you for your suggestions. And we will carry this item over till next Tuesday.
The annexation thing and the... Oh, did you want to vote?
Oh, sure. Yeah.
It was actually in the roll anyway, sort of odd. Actually, you probably don't want to vote. Anytime the word annexation in there, I start getting scared.
I would have voted no.
Yeah.